Hello, everybody. Welcome in to the Lakers Collective. The Lakers get the win over the Sacramento Kings last night. Are they back on track? What does this mean? The starting lineup doesn't change in ways that we expected it to. Is that a problem moving forward? We'll talk a little bit about that as well. We'll get into the absence of Austin Reaves. We just got all-star voting returns. We'll touch upon that. And we're going to try to spend the bulk of this show doing what we can to get to your questions, your comments. I know we've been a little bit behind on that lately, so we want to make sure we get to that. Happy to see you all here coming in on the YouTube channel. I'm Trevor Lane. He's Jovan Buha, Jason Temp. Guys, nice to be back after a win. The three-game losing streak, it's over.
It was actually fun to watch them last night. That's the, you know, it's funny. You drop a game to the Suns where Austin and Luka are out, and you theoretically shouldn't care, but like they just, I hated the way they played. It wasn't fun to watch them. They weren't playing hard. And that's the thing. Like, it's the Kings, not a great team. But there was just a level of spirit and energy that made them more fun to watch. And most importantly, it's great to see you guys. I'm excited to talk about the game today.
Great to see you guys. First double-digit win since November 30th, nearly a month ago. I thought this was their best two-way performance of the month. Probably their second, or arguably their best defensive performance of the month, and then their second best offensive performance of the month. So, yes, it was the Kings. It does not erase the three-game losing streak. It does not erase their struggles against some of the top teams in the West, some of the more athletic teams in the West. But it was nice to see, like, you can't control the team you play coming out of a skid, right? All you can do is control what's in front of you and how you handle that opponent. I thought they handled the Kings reasonably well. I thought they took care of business for most of that game. And after a little bit of a shaky start from that point on, They blew the Kings out. So I thought it was exactly the type of response you wanted to see coming out of the three-game losing streak.
Yeah, absolutely. You knew everybody would dismiss this because it's just the Sacramento Kings, and perhaps rightfully so. But nonetheless, the Lakers, I thought, did play much better, played with much more focus. I thought this was the closest to a, I don't want to say 48-minute game because there were some garbage time minutes in there, but there was only a period of maybe 2 or 3 minutes tops in this game where the Lakers, during the competitive portions of the game, actually, you know, they flipped the switch off for a little bit. There was one, like, weird, quick Luka three from, like, 10 feet behind the three-point line, and they got a little discombobulated for a few minutes. But for the most part, they were very intentional. They were very focused. We saw much more organized offense. I thought the defensive effort was certainly there. Jason, not a surprise, but people very quick to dismiss what they saw, though. And to be fair, some of it has to be, well, it is the Sacramento Kings. So how do you weigh that? Like, how much of it is Sacramento's not very good versus the Lakers played much better than what we've seen before? Like, how do you balance those two things?
You know, I think it was both, obviously. I think if you had to talk about which, anytime you go down in competition to this extent, everything gets easier, right? Like, I was kind of just watching all these simple dynamics, like, oh, there's nobody on this team that really has a chance to guard Luka, or like, you know, it's really nice being on the other side of these Russell Westbrook possessions where he's just dribbling out at the top of the key and fumbling the ball right into the guy guarding him, or like rushing into a pull-up jump shot off the dribble. Like, there's certain things where just playing Sacramento makes life easier, right? Like, DeMar DeRozan was doing a good deal of switch hunting in this game, and he got really hot early in the game with his little mid-range jump shot, to the point where, you know, I was thinking as I was watching, I'm like, these are some pretty good contests. Like, I wonder if DeMar will cool off eventually, and he eventually did. But like, there's just not a lot that Sacramento brings to the table in terms of being imposing in any sort of facet of the game, which is going to make life easier. But again, like, there's a lot to dig into with this recent stretch from the Lakers. Like, a lot of the issues that we talk about mostly come down to the top teams in the league. Like, you know, with, you know, Jovan has made a lot of really good points regarding the starting lineup over the course of this season. And I thoroughly agree with him, for the record. Like, I don't think Rui can start anymore. I think the information is overwhelming in that regard. But when you really dig into it, it's like the sheer degree to which they were getting cracked in these starting lineup looks was more complicated than just Rui slow-footed and LeBron slow-footed and Luka slow-footed. That stuff was bleeding through and you could see it, and it's why you can't go that route in the big picture as you're trying to pit yourself against the best teams in the league. But Luka can do a better job not turning the ball over in his first shift, and he did last night. You know, LeBron can do a better job with his defensive rotations and just overall trying to make an effort on the defensive glass. There are, down the line, a lot of different things that guys could do better. Ayton had his best defensive effort, I thought, last night than he's had in a long time. And it's like two things can be true. The lineup is flawed. They also can play better. And so I do think that there was a lot of stuff down the line and those guys playing better. You're never going to turn something around like this overnight. Like for instance, the Pistons game tomorrow. That's going to be a really tough game. And even if the Lakers do play hard, it might not necessarily be enough because of the issues that they have. But every day you're either practicing becoming better or you're practicing becoming worse. And I did think yesterday's game was an example for 48 minutes-ish of the Lakers going out there and being like, we want to play serious basketball. We want to establish better habits and we want to get into a groove that could potentially carry us when we do run into tougher teams. And they are, like, Memphis is a tough team too. They got some tough games this week. And I thought last night was just a good step in the right direction as they prepare for that stretch.
Jovan, I got to ask, whatever phone case you use, I'd imagine it was put to the test last night when the starting lineup was released.
Yeah, look, I'm not gonna change my opinion on this, and I came on here and said as much, and I said it on my show as well. Like, I don't believe the Luka, LeBron, Rui trio can play together against serious teams. The Sacramento Kings are not a serious team. They have been playing better lately, and they have racked up some wins against some solid teams. But I mean, this was a team entering this game that was bottom three on both sides of the ball. They had the 29th ranked offense. Like, by any measure, they are a bottom three or four team in the NBA. So I don't want to take too much from that. But I will note, like, the Lakers have not had, we've talked about it before, not had a lot of blowout wins. This was just their second 20-plus point victory on the season. And their first in, since the Milwaukee game, which was over a month and a half ago. So I do want to give, I want to acknowledge that they played better last night and that there were certainly some encouraging things on both sides of the ball. With regard to the starting lineup, they were plus eight in 12 minutes. But they did lose the opening shift, which, like, JJ before and after the game talked about the slow starts that this group continues to get out to, and being down in the first quarter or being down at halftime. It had also been the first time JJ only does the halftime interview when the team is up at halftime. The Lakers have not been up at halftime since December 4th in Toronto.
It's been almost a month. At halftime.
Yeah, he joked about it. It's been almost a month since he talked to Mike Trudell at halftime. Part of it is just, like, they're constantly down. Like, in the Houston game, for example, they never had a shot to really get back into that game because they were down 12 points within a few minutes because of the starting group. So I think it was nice to see them, like, they went on a little bit of a run with the starting group in the second quarter. Then they opened the third with a run, and then Sacramento returned the favor, and then they pulled LeBron. So plus eight in 12 minutes, like, you take that in most matchups. I think in the context of this specific game and how this game went, that was, like, a little underwhelming compared to how some of the bench lineups performed. But they were plus one in the first half. They were minus one in their first shift. And it just continues to be a thing where they are playing from behind or right there when the bench comes in, and then the bench gives them a boost. And I think the obvious solution is just balance out. Like, one thing I'm curious to kind of kick this back to you guys is, one thing I've really liked over the last stretch of, like, week and a half or so has been some combination of two offensive minded players, two banshees, and a center. And I thought we've seen, like, when the Lakers have gone on their runs, it's been some combination of that. And last night, Nick Smith Jr., we have to give him a shout out, had an incredible game. But moving forward, some combination of, you know, it could be Luka and LeBron plus two banshees and a center, or Luka and, Gabe's going to be coming back. He's kind of in between an offensive minded player and a defensive minded player. I think he's going to play. I'm just stating that. But some, like, LeBron and Nick Smith, I think, have pretty good two man chemistry already. Austin eventually once he's back, but, like, two offensive minded guards / creators, playmakers. Then two defenders, whether it's Vando, Marcus, Jake LaRavia, whoever you want to put in there, and then a center with DA or Jackson. Like, that to me is the optimal lineup construction moving forward. You're not going to get that with the starting group because it's going to be the big three plus ideally a Banshee and then a center. But outside of those minutes, I think everything moving forward should be two offensive guys, two Banshees, and a center. And that balance to me is ideal. They could do that with the starting group. They're clearly choosing not to, but it was progress for now, but I think they're probably going to lose. I think they're going to lose the starting minutes against Detroit.
I think that's definitely fair to, I mean, they got away with the starting lineup against the Kings. They got away with it. I thought that part of it too was just the effort level was much, much better. And so that helped to mitigate some of the concerns that would be there with that starting group. I do like that concept of balancing things out between the Banshees and the offensive players. I do think that it speaks to a bigger problem for the Lakers that we've seen now for years. And it's the same conversation we've been having, that come playoff time, can you have players who are deficient on one side of the ball or the other out there on the floor? If you're facing an opponent that does not, that has two-way players, that's where you ultimately run into problems and you get tripped up. But for the meantime, in terms of getting wins right now, especially without Austin Reeves available, Gabe Vincent's not available, you've got Jackson Hayes wasn't available, trying to balance things out that way probably gives you the best version of still having a ceiling in terms of your production without having an extremely low floor as well, which is kind of what you see when you get the all defense groups out there, you know, where the floor is, oh no, we don't get a stop, and now we're caught in the half court with a bunch of guys that aren't really going to be defended. If you go all offense, then it's, you can't get stops. I think having that balance is probably the optimal way to approach things with this group. And so I'd like to see that continue moving forward. I did like what we saw out of Nick Smith, and I wonder if he can continue to be a bit of a weapon. Not that you're expecting, what did he get, 21 points every single night out of him, but can he be somebody on that side of the ball to help you out there? And I talked about this a little bit last night too, not to derail this into a Nick Smith conversation, but does Nick Smith's performance or recent performances give a little bit more confidence should you move on from Gabe Vincent that you don't necessarily need to get another guard back in return should you find a trade? But Jason, what do you think conceptually about that idea of balancing your offensive and defensive players and that just being the path forward for the Lakers, especially for the next, let's call it from now till the All-Star break, which is probably about when we're assuming that Austin Reeves will be actually getting back out onto the court?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jovan's on to something just in general with this team about understanding what they are on offense, which is they're not a driving kick team. They're just not. So having super high level spot up shooters on the floor, it's just the way that they play, these guys are getting left open in the corner all night long. And they're not making shots anyway, although it's been nice to see Vando hit a couple of threes, at least adding some legitimacy to what looked like some better form coming into the season. But LeBron, Austin, and Luka all take a lot of shots directly out of action, you know, as the ball handler in pick and roll, as the guys facing up in the post or facing up in ISOs. There's a great deal of on-ball shot making with this team, which makes it so that they can get away with more in terms of these, you know, kind of like defensive minded role players. So just in general, putting out lineups with four offensive minded guys on the perimeter doesn't really make a lot of sense with this group, just because they're not playing Boston Celtics ball where Tatum and Brown are breaking the defense down at the first, you know, part of the possession and then getting three, four driving kicks and everyone's involved or like any sort of like equal opportunity offense. It's not the way they play. So in general, I think with the starting lineup and with all their lineup configurations, I like the idea of just anchoring defensive talent around two guys who can run action in some way, shape, or form. I think Luka can get away with running action by himself if he needs to, if you have to, like in this stretch right now where Austin's out. I think we have just a very, very large set of data that shows that if you put LeBron with a ball handling guard that is small and is guarded by smaller players, it just is a great kind of foundation for an offense. Like we've seen it with him and Austin, we've seen it with him and Nick Smith, and he's even done it over the years a little bit with Gabe. But like, if he can just run action with a guard where he's the screener, and if he gets the switch, he goes down to the post, draws that second defender and just kind of plays out of it, they get plenty of good stuff out of that sort of thing. And they do a good enough job defensively with those groups that they can hold their water as they have continually throughout this season. So like, I think that's kind of the general formula is take whoever the small guard is, whether it's Nick or Austin, put him with LeBron. Luka is more capable of holding lineups by himself. Maybe Marcus is his number two. Maybe it's Gabe when he comes back. But then having those Laravia Vando types at the forward position almost at all times in those units to make sure that they have the defensive talent they need to compete.
So that would suggest no Rui and LeBron as well.
Yeah, I would have Rui with Luka, and then I'd have LeBron with Laravia and the other small guard in Jackson, essentially just throughout the game. When he's on the floor without Luka.
I think there's an element of that too, where people will take that as a negative for Rui. I think that I flip it. I think that's a very big positive. I think Luka does a great job finding Rui when he is open in those corners for that corner three that he's so good at. I think that is not just a step towards what the lineups that you're talking about, as well as what Jovan's been talking about. I think that's a step towards not just optimizing the Lakers in general, but I think that's also how you get the best version of Rui Hachimura.
Yeah, I think, and you know, what we're talking about, like two offensive-minded players, two banshees or defenders, whatever you want to call them. You could have like, let's just say, it's like Luka and Rui are the two offensive-minded players, and then Marcus is also out there as a secondary ball handler, playmaker, but he's also a banshee technically, or Jake can do a little bit of second side ball handling in a certain context. So I think it's about just finding that optimal balance of, it doesn't technically have to be two guards. I think Rui should be lumped into that offensive minded player list. But it's more so about the balance. And again, I think this has been now a season long trend with this group. We're a third of the way into the season, and now we have enough of a sample size, even though a lot of guys have been injured. A lot of guys have been in and out, that they haven't had the requisite continuity maybe that they would like, but in general, the Lakers have been better when they are balancing the bench and the starting group, and they continue to win in spite of the starting group, not because of the starting group. So I think that the clear trend there is that when they have one, like the defense just looks so much better when it's Marcus and Vando, or Vando and Jake, or Marcus and Jake out there. It just makes such a dramatic difference defensively, as expected. But like, I think, you know, they're not like all defense caliber guys, right? But just the gap between them and the starting group defensively, if you just take out one or two guys, it just makes such a difference that, to Jason's point, like the Lakers can get away with having one or two shot creators out there instead of, you know, three or four, because those guys are so elite in, you know, how they're able to generate high percentage looks and just their ISO game and attacking out of the pick and roll, that those guys, like Luka's going to be fine, LeBron's going to be fine, they're going to do their thing. They need help on the other side of the floor, and that continues to be why I beat this drum for a longer term starting lineup change. Because again, like when you're down 12 in 5 minutes to Houston, the game's not over, but you're now in a pretty big hole that you have to work your way out of. And I just don't think they can consistently work their way out of that. And again, especially like, yes, it's a relatively small sample size, and one performance could dramatically swing some of these numbers in either direction. But most of the time they're getting blown out in these starting groups, it's against good teams. And like, I just think we now have seen five or six times where their starting group cannot contend with the other top starting lineups in the league. So I think longer term, this needs to be a change, but it seems like the coaching staff does not agree for now.
There's some strong lineup data too. So Luka, Marcus, and Rui with LeBron and Austin off is +6 per 100 possessions and 217 possessions. And then that LeBron, Jake Laravia, Vando unit with Luka off is just crushing. They're +23 per 100 possessions. So there's some strong kind of like data that supports that if you partner Marcus and Rui with Luka, and you partner Jake and Vando plus whoever the small guard is with LeBron, that's your best formula. And like Jovan said, just with a center, whoever that is that's available that night.
I do want to mention the super chat here. Since Sacramento beat Denver, Minnesota, Houston in the last month without Sabonis and LaVine, don't let anyone take this win away. Look, anybody can win on any given night, yeah, especially if the opponent takes them lightly or something like that. you got to win over an NBA team, but I also don't think this is not the same as, whoa, okay, the Lakers went out there and they just beat Denver, let's say, right, last night, and really showed something that makes us feel a little bit better about that three-game losing streak. No, I don't think this is going to ease the fears about the team, but it was nonetheless good to see them step up in the way that they certainly needed to. Whether or not that's sustainable in terms of their attention to detail on the defensive side of the ball, the effort that was put in, the second efforts that we saw from them, I think that will continue to be a question until they show that it's not. And so I think it's a good win, no question, but I don't think it's necessarily easing fears completely. We still need to see this team get some quality wins here. Before we leave this topic, though, I want to ask you guys, JJ Redick threw out there 250 minutes. He's been told from those upstairs, I'm paraphrasing, but that 250 minutes is what you need to see to effectively be out of small sample size territory. Jovan, do you agree with that? And do you think did he really mean 250 minutes or did he mean 250 possessions? Either way, these lineups that we're talking about are well short of either one of those numbers. But do you agree with that we need to have that bigger sample size?
Yes and no, because this has been a trend with the Lakers for several years now, where I believe, I could be mistaken on this, but I think it's at least with the starting group. I don't know how many other lineups have reached that 250-minute threshold. I think only one Lakers lineup over the past 40 years has even reached the 250-minute threshold. So I think at some point you have to throw out the ideal of how you view a lineup or when it hits certain benchmarks in terms of minutes and possessions. And it's like, we could take the extreme here, right? Like a small ball lineup of Nick Smith Jr., Gabe Vincent, Marcus Smart, Austin Reeves, and Dalton Knecht. We don't need to see that lineup to know that lineup would not be a good lineup. And like you could use some critical thinking skills to assess the weaknesses in that group and say, hey, that lineup should never play together under any circumstances unless it's garbage time. I know I'm making an extreme example there, but I think similarly, looking at the starting group, one at full strength, you see that the Lakers are starting their five best offensive players / scorers, and I would say maybe one above average defender, like I guess one above average defender. And that's an issue. And when they still only have these like pockets of 6 minutes, 8 minutes, 10 minutes played together in games, but they're consistently losing those minutes. So I get the, like, if you want to be stubborn and view it like, hey, they've played something like 85 minutes together and we need double or triple the sample size, so be it. I just think that's more like confirmation bias from the coaching staff in terms of, we believe in this lineup and we're going to go down, riding this lineup until the end. But depending on who, I've talked to Krangis about this. It's about like 500 possessions offensively and 850 possessions defensively is when lineups like stabilize in terms of what you can expect. The Lakers are probably not going to get that many possessions with this group, throughout the rest of the season. But I just think, I think we've seen enough, especially within the context of like them versus good teams, that we could retire it. And also like Ayton, LeBron and Rui, Ayton, LeBron, there's a quartet. And then there's also the trio of Luka, LeBron and Rui. They're almost at 200 minutes played together, and they're depending on the configuration, it's like somewhere between a minus 10 to minus 16. So that one is like already almost at the 250 minutes of like, that's just not a trio that should be playing together. So I think it's enough of a sample size. I don't think we need to see them go down 10 to 12 points 5 minutes into a game five more times to be like, hey, this doesn't really work.
When what you would predict coming into an experiment is already being confirmed in these situations, and it's a negative thing, I think you have reason to stop doing that thing. Now, that said, the Lakers did have much better effort level there. They clearly were fired up. The interesting, the way JJ described their practice from the other day, it didn't sound like the uncomfortable practice, at least not for the players. Sounded like it was mostly the players talking to the coaches rather than the other way around.
He walked it back.
They definitely did. And I firmly believe that there are only so many times over the course of a season. There's a limited number of times over the course of a season when a coach can push the button where they're screaming and yelling, they're, you know, snapping clipboards over their knee and throwing chairs and all that kind of stuff. You can only do that so many times before it starts falling on deaf ears and they start tuning you out. So if JJ ultimately decided, you know what, I'm heated after the game against Houston, I cool off between now and then, I'm going to adjust my strategy, whatever it was, it worked. Whatever the strategy was, it worked. Whether it was hellfire and brimstone coming and JJ's just breathing fire or not, and clearly it was not, it worked because we saw a much more focused and locked in Lakers team. Jason, with the level of effort that they played with in last night's game, the way they defended, the communication level, which JJ called out, even if the lineups are not optimal, if they play at that baseline level that we saw, is that enough to get them back on track, even without, because it doesn't seem like they're going to optimize the lineups the way we're talking about anytime soon.
Yeah, you know, again, I think, first of all, humiliation works quite a bit. This happened last year with the Miami game, if you guys remember. It was like, sure, it was just such an embarrassing performance where they just, and this is where like the Laker fan base, I think, actually kind of works to their benefit in the sense that like the Laker fan base just doesn't take any shit. And so they're just like, if you remember last year after the Miami game, they just got utterly lambasted by like every Laker fan for days on end after that. And it kind of sparked a renewed effort throughout the rest of the season. Again, like, I think quickly on the lineup data, you know, I think there is truth to the fact that any small sample is going to have noise. Like, we've talked about this before, but like the starting lineup would perform better statistically if Luka was better offensively in the first shift in some of these games. That is something that is coloring the data. But again, we can't make all of our decisions based purely on data either. Like, we have to look at what's happening on the screen, to Jovan's point. Like, I can watch the Lakers and be like, okay, they're not as bad statistically as they look here because Luka is capable of playing much better to start these games than he has. But they look slow. But Rui's not really involved in the offense a ton in these earlier units anyway. Maybe he'd be better utilized in a bench group. But there's this lack of energy where why not put like a natural motor guy out there that's going to come out from the opening tip and bring energy and effort and see if, like, by the way, like Marcus was out there last night to start. Like, that brings energy and effort that makes it so that Luka, LeBron, and Rui are kind of lifted by that emotional effort that Marcus brings to the situation. So like the point is, yeah, there's truth to the fact that the data has noise in it, but there's this obvious stuff that we're seeing on film that has to be a part of the decision as well. It can't just be let's read net ratings and change our lineup. It's got to be a combination of both. And I do think that there was some obvious eye test stuff. Now, as far as it being signs of a turnaround, like, again, I do think that the pendulum has swung too far on the Lakers, okay? Like, they have won 5 games this season against teams that are above the play-in in either conference. They have won 3 games this year against teams that I consider to be second-tier contenders. So, like, they are capable of performing better. I do think this stretch has been deeply revealing as it pertains to their ability to beat certain teams, certain types of teams, and there are certainly things that they're going to have to address in order to compete against those teams, but this team's 20-10. They're absolutely capable of ripping off, you know, a 10-3 stretch here to try to kind of turn things around. Like, they are capable of playing better than they have been, even if we can admit these flaws exist. And most of it comes down to, again, like LeBron setting the tone at the start of games by making the defensive rotations he wasn't in the last couple of weeks. And I was talking about this on my show today. Is there a player on the Lakers on the perimeter who is better suited to win battles on the ground in terms of box outs and to vertically beat people to the basketball on the defensive glass than LeBron is? No, he's their best weapon. He's arguably their best perimeter defensive rebounder. They need him to anchor them on that end of the floor. They need him to support them on defense as a backline communicator and rotator. If he comes out in games and does that, and if Luka comes out and takes care of the basketball and is efficient with his shot making, bam, just like that, a bunch of their problems become a lot easier to solve. And does that mean they're going to go beat Detroit tomorrow night, or they're going to go beat the best teams in the league? Certainly that's more complicated because of the roster limitations, but this team was playing trash kit ball for a couple of weeks. They're definitely capable of being better than they looked in these games.
I like that, trash kit ball. I haven't heard that one before. That's good.
I like it.
I like it. But I agree with you. Yes, they, if you are getting that from them, they have the ability to be certainly much better than what we saw recently. Maybe there is that embarrassment factor that you were talking about as well after the loss to the Rockets, especially Christmas Day in the spotlight. And that's what had us so upset last game, was not just, you know, how they lost, but also the energy level that we saw from the team in that kind of a game was certainly frustrating. Before we get into the chat, I do want to mention that the All-Star voting returns did come out. Luka Doncic leading the entire NBA in fan voting with 1.25 million votes so far for Luka. LeBron ninth in the West with just over 500,000 votes, and Austin Reeves 10th in the West with 400,000 votes. Any surprise on those returns, with Luka being so far out ahead of LeBron and Austin, or you know, appears Luka is a lock for the All-Star game, LeBron and Austin more of a question? What are your guys' thoughts on that?
I'm a little surprised by how low LeBron is, based on, you know, just as recently as last year, how high he was in the All-Star voting. Because right now, I mean, it's the first returns. A lot could change theoretically, but typically the first return is pretty close to what it ultimately is, because they're going positionless, right? Like, they're going with the five in each conference, and then they'll do the benches. And then once they have the full 24 man group, they will split that into the two American teams and then the one world team. But right now it would be Luka, Jokic, Curry, Shea, Wemby as the starting five in the West, which probably feels about right. I think you could quibble with maybe Steph versus Ant for that final, fifth spot there. But I mean, that feels right. It feels odd to see LeBron behind KD, behind Denny, and even behind Wemby and Ant to some degree, right? Like, I think if we're basing on performance, obviously LeBron is not an all-star starter, but just based on his popularity and just how he's always been the leading vote getter or the leading vote getter in his conference, or at least like top three, I think that's a little surprising to me.
Yeah, I thought the same. I thought LeBron would carry enough of the fan vote where that would carry him into an all-star spot. I think he'll get some votes from the players, but I wonder with him being so low on the fan vote, does he make the all-star team this year? Like, I think I have some real questions about that. Seeing this first return, I am surprised that LeBron is farther down, because you do get a lot of fans voting that aren't paying attention to how many games a guy's played, and they're just voting based on names and all of that. So I'm surprised to see LeBron sitting at ninth right now.
Yeah, I think if I'm LeBron, I think LeBron would probably prefer to go on vacation anyway. But I think I wouldn't be surprised if he finds his way in there, just because the league desperately needs more energy surrounding All-Star Weekend, and if LeBron James isn't there, that certainly hurts. So I wouldn't be surprised. I think the Austin Reeves injury kind of lets the league off the hook a little bit, because it would have been kind of ridiculous if three Lakers made the All-Star team, considering how they've looked. So I think Austin's injury probably takes him out of the mix. And if LeBron ends up getting some sort of like legacy vote from the league, then you'll end up with two All-Stars.
Yep.
I'm surprised Luka was number one, actually.
Who do you think on merit, who should be number one?
I mean, strictly on merit, you got to go with Jokic, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think you do.
But factoring in like jersey sales and what, there was that social graphic of who was the most consumed player over the last 12 months, that was Luka. So,
yeah.
I mean, certainly he's becoming one of the faces, if not the face of the league right now.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, the jersey sales, he was the first non LeBron or Curry player to lead the NBA in jersey sales since like 2012 or something like that. Something crazy when he became a Laker, which only fueled conspiracy theories that much more after that trade. All right. Let's we said we wanted to spend a decent amount of time on the chat today and get into some of your questions, some of your comments. Of course, the Lakers taking on the Pistons. We've got a lot to look forward to with that. But let's get into this here. We'll go with a question directed to Jovan. Why doesn't the media address the Rui starting elephant in the room with JJ presenting objective data in such a way that he doesn't get offended? That's a fine line to walk, isn't it?
It is a fine line to walk. It is something that is on my mind, and we were actually discussing before the show, like the proper way to frame this type of topic with JJ, because he has been very defensive with both the starting group. Anytime he's been asked about the starting group going back to training camp, he has been very defensive on that front. And even recently, it was kind of teasing like, hey, see, you guys are asking me about the starting group. And I told you that it doesn't matter what my starting group is, because we're going to have a bunch of injuries and a bunch of guys are going to be in and out. And while that is true to an extent, like when fully healthy, he has had the opportunity to choose his starting group. And he has made the wrong decision, in my opinion. But with lineup data as well, JJ has also been very defensive. So I think I've been trying to workshop like the into the topic, into the question, without getting him defensive, without getting him on his heels, because I could still ask it, right, and at least make the attempt. But I think that the most effective way would obviously be framing it in a certain context to get him to at least entertain it and ideally open up and just discuss the topic of Rui starting. So I've been thinking about this. Admittedly, I was not at the Christmas game. I was not at the game last night. Been spending time with family here during this, like this is like the 1 week of the year that I'm prioritizing family time over games and stuff. So I'm still covering the games, but have not been there. Like, I wanted to ask this ideally ahead of the Sacramento game, especially coming off of the practice and the three losses. I didn't get a chance to, but next time it makes sense to ask the question and I'm able to ask the question, I do want to ask it. I think he will likely push, like, you know, one thing he's noted with last year's starting group was they were good defensively last year. And I think you could also look at, well, hey, it didn't really materialize in the playoffs. And last year was last year. You had Jackson starting instead of DA, but I've been thinking about this because I think it's an important question. I wish, you know, if I'm not going to ask it, someone else would ask it, but it doesn't seem like anyone else has any interest in this. So I'm going to ask it. I don't know if I'm going to get the response that everybody wants.
Well, it's an important question too, because fans are largely asking, and in part because we're talking about it, but fans are starting to ask, why does this happen? When the lineup came out last night, I had so many replies from people upset that Rui was still in the starting lineup. And what people tend, when there's an absence of information, a lot of times people tend to go to the worst thing. And that's, well, JJ doesn't know what he's doing, right? That's the answer that I see people jump to. That's where you want to hear, what is the thought process? Clearly, the Lakers coaching staff, JJ included, see things differently than we do when it comes to this. I'd be curious to find out what that is. What is it that he's seeing that's causing that decision? Because it could be that there's an explanation that does make some sense. I don't necessarily see it, but I'd be curious to find out what that thought process is, because I guarantee you it's not, well, JJ just doesn't know what he's doing, which is the leap that a lot of fans make. So I think it's important that we find out What is the decision-making process? What is the thought process behind this? Why are you continuing to go with this lineup?
I do think that there's potential for some sort of politic situation going on behind the scenes. There could be,
agreed.
There could be like a directive up top that says like, hey, until we trade Rui, I want him starting, so that he's viewed around the league as a starter and not as a bench player. Like, there, you just don't know what's going into this sort of situation. I think that it's ridiculous for us just to assume that JJ doesn't see what we're seeing. You know what I mean? That doesn't necessarily mean that he's making the right decision, but it just means that, like, it could be a little bit more complicated than we think, even though I think we all agree that a change needs to be made. It may just be that they're not going to, because they know a trade's going to be made in a month and they want to, you know, reflect Rui as a starter in the league or something. It just could be a little bit more complicated than we think on the surface.
All right, let's go here. Kevin, well, threw up.
The only thing I would add to that is just funny, because JJ will reference slow starts them. Like, still, the first quarter has been there. The first quarter has been their only negative, like, by net rating, the first quarter continues to be their only negative net rating quarter, right? That they're winning the other three quarters. They're losing the first quarter for some mysterious reason that we can't seem to decipher and you know figure out, like, why are they losing first quarters? I don't know. It's a mystery. So that's the funny thing is, like, he has said some things where you're like, you know, we need better energy to start games. We keep getting off to these slow starts. We keep losing first halves. I don't know. I wonder why.
It is one of life's great mysteries, for sure. Kevin said, look at New York. They have OG, McHale, Hart, Robinson around JB and Towns, and they are 15th in defense this year, 14th last year. If LA build around Luka and AR in the future, it's at best an average defense no matter what. Is that the way we see the pairing of Austin? Because they were, at one point this season, they were 15th in defense with Austin and Luka, and that was with non-optimal defensive pieces around them. Do you buy this premise? Because I don't, that the ceiling defensively is 15th. I don't buy that that's actually the ceiling. I think that's going too far.
I think the Knicks, too, have had stretches of, like, really good defense this year, even though they have their entry points. The Lakers have had the weakness of having entry points and weak surrounding defensive personnel. There's, like, a level that the Knicks can get to when OG and McHale and Josh Hart are flying around that is substantially higher defensively than what the Lakers have been able to get to. Now, the case for making some sort of move around the Luka and Austin is, if you flip Rui into some sort of small forward type of dude, can you reach a level where you get, like, the good version of Ayton that we've seen this year, where he's this dynamic rim protector because he's just big and he's active down there, and LeBron's engaged defensively and he's making the rotations and he is flying around on defense. And then you have this other 6'8 dude who's, like, sprinting around and covering ground in rotation, guarding the ball, doing all that kind of stuff. Is there a version of that that can get to the level defensively? And I do think that that's doable, not necessarily, you know, top 10 in the league or anything, but I do think we've seen multiple examples around the league of teams that have, like, you know, Jokic and Murray or Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns that are able to be more competent defensively than this Lakers team has been able to show.
Looking at the data quickly here, this season with Luka and Austin on, the Lakers have a, and this is NBA Wowie, so it's eliminating some of the garbage time and whatnot, but 121.8 offensive rating, which would be the second best offensive rating in the entire NBA behind just Denver, and a 113 defensive rating, which would be 10th in the NBA, right there behind Dallas and ahead of Phoenix. So the issue has not been Luka and Austin together, and this even goes back to last season. It has been other variations. And now I will say, if you have Luka and Austin together, I do think you need a specific build to get to a championship level. And I think that the build has to be two quality perimeter defenders, one of the big wing or forward variety, one of the smaller wing or guard variety. And I think the optimal roster build is, like, Austin is the secondary backcourt defender. Then you have a defender who's the primary guy. Because right now LA is using Austin as the primary guy when, like, fully mm-hmm. healthy with the starting group, and Rui as the wing stopper. Like, that's not the best
that's
way to do that. So you want, like, that bigger 3-and-D type, and then you want a smaller guard, you know, type. And then I think that, like, that's the proper way. So Luka's the secondary or even, like, third front court defender that you're kind of hiding. Austin is on the secondary guard and the other players taking that primary guy. And then you have the rim protecting center, you know, rim runner. So I think you do need a specific build around those guys. And I would argue the Lakers not only don't have that build right now, but also don't really empower the ideal lineups to support those guys. So that's where some of the shortcomings have popped up defensively, but they've defended at a top 10 level with those two on the floor. So I don't think we can point to that specifically and say it doesn't work. The thing is, when you look at, like, more into the lineup data, a lot of that has come with Jackson at the five or some variation of the Banshees in there. So they have been more successful when you blend the bench and the starting group. But Austin and Luka, again, small, like, relatively small sample size, so I don't want to take away, like, too much of that. But up to this point in the season, they have defended at a top 10 level.
Yeah, and I understand why conceptually there's questions or reason for concern about having the two of them on the floor defensively, but I think particularly if you
actually,
do have...
it's 401 minutes, so it is more than JJ's 250-minute threshold.
That's a good amount. I mean, I do think there's an argument to be had for having a true rim-protecting, agile, athletic big behind them as well. Like, that would do wonders, and that's not necessarily DeAndre Ayton. Not that Ayton has had a bad season. I think he's been very good, especially at his price tag at $8 million. He's done a really nice job for them. But if you were to truly optimize a Luka and Austin pairing, that's probably what we're talking about in terms of the other three players being around them. Having that athleticism, having a point of attack defender, having a primary wing defender, having that big that can erase shots, that can make up for mistakes, that's probably what you're going to need. And so if you do have that optimization, and it's not easy to find those pieces, but if you do have that, I don't buy that league average defense is their ceiling. I would buy that top 10 is probably, like, they're not going to crack top 5. Right? Because you do have some weak points that can be attacked. The question is, can you be top 10 on both sides of the ball? Can you have a team built around Luka and Austin that is top 10 defensively, which I think they can get there? Are they going to be top 5? Probably not. But can they also have a top 10, maybe even top 5 offense? That's where you can say, boom, you've got a contender. And that is the true path forward for this team. And that may be, and frankly, what we're describing is indeed a post-LeBron world. That may be a this summer when they've got a bunch of flexibility. They could be one of the top cap space teams in the NBA. That's when we can start to see that vision truly come into focus for the Lakers. Until that point, it's going to be about piecing things together in a way that can get things done in the present. But ultimately, I think if the plan is going to be to build around Luka and Austin, that's going to have to be the path that they head down. That's going to be the roster that they're going to have to, I don't want to use the word aspire because Clippers, but that they attempt to put together.
They just have to plant some trees and it'll all work out.
Plant some seeds and let them grow there. Lakers should target Koulibaly and Justin Champagne. I don't know if Washington's going to be moving on from those guys anytime soon. I guess it would depend. The Lakers have traded with the Wizards in the past in a way that I had benefited the Wizards quite a bit. The Rui trade was good, but the Russell Westbrook trade, maybe not so much. But sure, those are the kinds of guys you should target. But if I'm Washington, I'm not parting with any of my young, especially young wings right now. If I'm them, I'm just trying to build for the future and keep my wings in place and see what I can do to take steps forward.
Yeah, Koulibaly is not going anywhere. But no. Justin Champagne has always been one of those guys that I've liked around the league that I think would be a nice kind of like bench swap kind of deal for the Lakers if they could pull that off.
All right, let's go here. Sorry, I lost it for a second. Oh, there we go. Watching Russ last night made me happy he isn't a Laker. No shade, but he would be driving me crazy. Had a stretch where he missed two shots, turned the ball over, then got blocked all in 2 minutes. LOL. That's kind of the Russ. That's the Russ experience, isn't it? It's hard because he's a legend. He is an all-time great. He's been an MVP. He's done some incredible things in this league. And he's done some good things for the Kings as well this year, but I don't know that he's conducive to winning basketball anymore. And that's been that way for a few years. That said, you consistently hear how great of a teammate he is. I want good things for Russ, but yes, I did not find myself pining for Russell Westbrook in a Lakers jersey watching last night's game.
That part was kind of cathartic last night. Yeah. No lie.
You took some joy in that.
Those were hard years, Trevor.
I was gonna say, I'm sad we missed that that era collectively together.
Oh man, we
would have had some fun moments.
A lot of vent sessions in that one.
I don't know about you guys, but I don't remember a lot of that year. I think on some like a psychological level, I have repressed some. Like I don't remember a lot of that season. I think I've repressed some of it because that was. Whew, those are some tough times.
Do you remember there were so many lows and it just kept getting lower. Remember the Portland game where he took the pull up mid-range jump shot at the elbow in transition?
Oh, I remember having a lot of conversations about if he could just cut this shot out of his shot diet, it would do wonders. I don't remember that specifically. Like I said, I I don't know. I probably was banging my head against the wall at that moment.
Fun times.
Let's go here. If we can get a defensive five back, would y'all move Ayton? Say a three-team deal where we send out Rui, DA, Kleba, Dalton Connect, picks, and get back Claxton and Josh Green. It's a lot of stuff going out.
Josh has looked okay since he came back. I like Claxton. Ayton is, it's tough. Like, I'd almost, the one thing with Claxton is you kind of feel a little bit better about him as a long-term kind of option with Luka. And it fits with the fact that JJ likes to switch. Claxton's a decent little switch big. There is a lot to give up, though, without getting a starting three.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I think it's a little bit too much. I will note, I have been a little bit more concerned with DA lately against the better teams. Like, I thought he got thoroughly outplayed by Alperen Şengün and Steven Adams in that game. I mean, they combined for 21, like, just very reductive analysis here, but they had 21 rebounds. He had two, right? And he led the game in minutes. He played 36 minutes more than anybody else, and he only had two rebounds. And like, there can be in some of these games where it starts to spiral for LA. I feel like he can then kind of join the spiraling rather than try to be a force that stops it. And I just feel like, I think he's clearly exceeded expectations. He's clearly exceeded the contract. And especially on the offensive end, I think he's been incredible. And even some of his rim protection stuff rates out pretty well. I think for like a championship level defense, I still think there are some questions for me. And when things are not going well, can he still, like, I don't worry about Marcus Smart when things aren't going well. Marcus is going to give you a certain baseline of effort and focus and urgency. Same thing with Vando. Same thing with Jake. Like, you know, Jake could have his 1-for-8 performances, but he's still giving you a certain level defensively that I would like to see more consistently from a player like DA.
DA, let's say, hypothetical scenario, he opts out. It doesn't pick up his player option this summer. And DA says, I love playing with Luka. I want to stay. Let's do 4 years, 80. Are you doing that?
That's tough, man. I like Ayton a lot more in a contract year than I do in a long-term deal. My thing is, like, you kind of have to unless you've got a better option. Because what you can't afford to do is let him walk for nothing and then start Jackson or something along those lines.
I'm going to add two caveats here. One, I would like to see how the rest of the season goes, and particularly the playoffs, right? Like, if they play Houston, let's say Houston LA is the 4-5, and they lose that series in five games, and he is just dominated in the paint against, you know, by Şengün and Adams, that would give me a lot of pause about retaining him, or at least not retaining him on a more team friendly deal. And then I think it's a minor thing, but I'd probably prefer a 3-year deal or even like a 2+1 rather than a 4-year deal. So if it was like 3 years, 60, and maybe he has a player option for the third, just to give him that wiggle room or give him a little bit of a concession of like, hey, we're not giving you the fourth year, but we'll give you a third year player option of, if you crush it the next 2 years, you have the optionality to opt out. That's maybe like a happy medium. But I think with a lot of these guys, like, I think with Rui to a degree, with DA, with some of the other bench guys, and then also even with Austin in terms of like the final number, I want to see how the rest of the season goes, and I want to see how the playoffs go, because this team, I think, is at the point where they could win 50 games, they could win 55 games, they could win 60 games, and it doesn't really matter if they don't at least advance a round or two in the playoffs, right? Like, if this team loses in the first round again, I think there are serious questions about the makeup of the roster and where they go moving forward.
No, very true. How he plays in the playoffs and how most of these guys that are going to be free agents play in the playoffs will certainly matter. And I should have included a player option, because, you know, it's, if you are negotiating with the Lakers and you don't ask for a player option at this point,
that's another thing.
Because you know it's coming. You know they're happy to add it in there. All right, let's go here. Y'all know more than 30 years of Lakers coaching staff. Don't hear what we're not saying. Don't hear. That's what we're saying. It would be nice to hear what is the coaching staff's side of that on the Rui conversation. Let's go here. Bad GM slash stubborn head coach combo is a torturous NBA reality for the smart fans to have to endure, and it feels like we're barreling towards that with how JJ is acting. I have seen a little bit more. Now, there's been pessimism in general over the last, you know, three games. Losing those three games obviously soured some things, and there's been frustration with the coaching staff for the rotations and the lineups. Where are we at? Jason, where are you at on JJ as an NBA head coach?
I am still putting him way, way, way far down on the list of any sort of issue slash criticism with this team. Again, like there's no doubt that from what we've seen, the starting lineup needs to be changed. But I do think that even if you would have started a better player in those spots with the way that Luka and LeBron have been playing in this stretch and with Austin being injured, it's hard to specifically point at the lineup structure solely as the reason why things look the way they look. If you kind of dig into these losses, like they lose to Houston, but Austin misses the entire second half. Not to justify the way they played, but that played a role. You lose to Phoenix. Austin and Luka are out in that game. If you dig back through most of their losses, the only times they've lost with all three dudes playing in all of the game is the San Antonio in-season tournament game, which, by the way, was the game where Austin looked so rough that that's when they shut him down, was right after that game. They're like, you need to take some time off. Your calf is clearly hurting. And then the other game, which was the first Suns game, where Luka and Austin had 14 turnovers between the two of them. So it's hard for me to like really, really dig into, you know, maybe this lineup structure or this specific, you know, issue that they're having on offense. Maybe they're not like, I do think that JJ, you could tell JJ called more plays and took a little bit more control over their offensive organization in the Kings game. But Luka's also capable of running spread pick and roll and not turning the ball over five times in a quarter. Like, he's capable. And so I think that when I look at the situation with JJ, if there's one thing that I'd be critical of him with, it's just the way he's handled some of his post-game pressers. This like super pissed off, like kind of like refusing to take any blame for anything kind of situation. It's just bad leadership, in my opinion. It's not even because I blame JJ. I don't blame JJ for the way the team has been playing, but he should probably go up there and take some blame just as the leader and just kind of take some of the pressure off those guys and manage the psychological part of it a little bit better. But in terms of like the X's and O's and the setting the team up for success stuff, I don't really have too many complaints for JJ beyond, you know, the starting lineup stuff, which, as we've talked about, could be a little bit more complicated than it looks at on the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yova, where are you? Jay, I agree with Jay. I think in general, I'm a positive on JJ and what we've seen from him so far. Could there be areas where it could be better? Sure. But I also think in the context of the Lakers hired him to be their coach, not just now, but into the future, and believe in not just the coach he is right now, but what he is going to become as a head coach. I think he's on the right trajectory right now overall.
I agree. I think the results have been there in the regular season. I thought going back in last season, and I'm curious to see how this season evolves. Like last season, I thought he showed a lot of growth in the second half of the season. And they had that stretch of 20 games or 24 games where they were the league's best defense. And JJ was throwing the fastball defensively in terms of opponent specific game plans that really worked. Like I think about that Denver game and the way that they defended Jokic, and that was one of the best defensive performances in a single game I've seen against Nikola Jokic. And Vando and Rui and LeBron and just the way that they were fronting him and basically guarding him all 94 feet. Didn't matter where he was, there was a body on him, bumping him, being physical and trying to front him and also deny the lob pass, sandwiching him. Like I thought that was, and then you could go like some of the Knicks performances and just some of those games that they had that really stood out. I thought there was tangible progress from JJ from like the first half of his rookie season to the second half. So we're almost at the halfway point. I will be interested to see how he develops in the second half of his second season. But I will say like, I think there's an element of similar to a lot of the role players. I'm going to judge JJ harsher on the playoff performance and the mm-hmm. decisions he makes. And let's just throw out this hypothetical. The starting lineup gets its ass kicked in game one against whoever they're playing. They haven't made a trade, or maybe they made a bench trade. They added like a bench 3-and-D guy. They're sticking with this starting group, and it's like a minus 13 in 12 minutes in game one. And then maybe it's like a little bit better, but like a minus 6 in like 10 minutes in game two. So he like reduces the minutes. Does he finally pull the plug and say, hey, we're down 2-0 in this series. We cannot go down 3-0 with this starting group. Or does he continue? Because based on his priors up to this point, like I would say that my biggest thing with JJ is I do think he's a bit dogmatic, and like he has certain things he believes in and will not budge on them, even if the data is against that. And so I do think a coach should have a certain conviction, certain beliefs. I'm not saying like you should just be too reactionary to the data, but he has shown that like he will go down with what he believes in to a potentially concerning degree, which I thought we saw in the Minnesota series. So I would say that's like my biggest concern with JJ right now. But ultimately, like he's won at a high rate in the regular season. And doing so without having much coaching experience, I think that is pretty impressive. I think he has pushed a lot of the right buttons with the rotation outside of this starting group. I have still a little bit of an issue with the switching defense and like the lack of creativity in terms of pre-switching and scram switching. I think they let their guys die on an island too frequently. That just to me is not the best strategy against the top offenses. But outside of that, I mean, I think I would probably give him a B+ overall for mm-hmm. his tenure, and whether that jumps into A range will be determined in the playoffs.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to sum it up. A B+ grade on JJ. All right, we've got a few more questions, comments we're going to get into. Want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, and that is SeatGeek. Use that code LakersCollective10 for 10% off with SeatGeek. We certainly do appreciate them. Be right back in 1 minute.
So my wife and I moved to Denver this summer, which means I'm finally back in an NBA city and I can go to NBA games again. So obviously I want to see the Lakers before the end of the season, especially before LeBron retires. So I've been looking at Lakers Nuggets in March coming up to see if I can get some tickets. And this is why I want to give the sponsor of today's video, SeatGeek, a huge shout out. With over 35 million downloads, SeatGeek is the number one rated ticketing app. They have over 70,000 events listed on the app, obviously concerts and festivals, but sports as well, the NBA, the NFL. They even have World Cup tickets on sale right now. And my favorite thing about the app is just how easy it is to find the best deal because of their deal score. So like these are the tickets to Lakers Nuggets in March. I can sort by deal, so I'm just looking at 10s on their deal score. These are all the best available deals in their respective sections, and look at how many options they have. So I can just pick the section in the arena I want to stay in or sit in, and I can find the best ticket in that section pretty easily. It makes that process so much easier. And they have your back. Every ticket is backed by their buyer guarantee. And of course, I have a code for you guys. You can use code LakersCollective10 for 10% off your next set of tickets at SeatGeek. That's 10% off any tickets with promo code LakersCollective10. Make sure you click on the link in the description to download the app and have the code automatically added to your account so you can use it later. Thank you to SeatGeek.
All right, everybody, again, use that code LakersCollective10. Go check out SeatGeek, great presenting sponsor for this show. We certainly do appreciate them. And if you guys haven't done so yet, please make sure you hit that subscribe button as well. We appreciate all of you who have come along on this journey. We genuinely enjoy coming here a couple times each week talking Lakers basketball with all of you. If you haven't done it yet, hit that subscribe button. Turn on those notifications as well. All right, let's do a few more here. We've got, is Luka's weight or conditioning a concern again? I've seen a bit of more sluggishness from Luka, certainly in the month of December. I think it's just one data point, but the steals numbers have been cut in half just about in the month of December. May have gone up to, I believe, he had 3 steals last night, so maybe that bumped back up a little bit. But I think we've seen less defensive activity from Luka in the month of December compared to November. Is that, guys, are we worried at all about the conditioning? I've seen people are starting to do the picture comparisons as well. Has Luka put on weight? What's your level of concern?
I'm not concerned. I think, I've seen the pictures. Does he look maybe a little bit heavier than he did earlier in the season? Sure, I won't deny that. But I think the bigger thing has been he has seemed banged up to me, and there have now been several times he's been grabbing at that calf, and that has given me some pause and a bit of fear with this situation of him continuing to play through that. And clearly at some point in the last few weeks, something happened where he has just not been right physically. And I think we've seen that decline in his 3-point shooting, the uptick in turnovers, and it just physically, he has not seemed quite at the level that he was at. Now, I'm not going to put that on weight and conditioning, because it has seemed more like, even if we want to say he maybe gained a little bit of weight, and again, that's like just pure speculation, I don't think that would explain some of the drop off we've seen from him. To me, it has looked like he's been worn down a bit and or dealing with some sort of injury. And I think, you know, we talked about earlier in the season, some of the minutes, right? Like the fact that he's been top three in minutes all season, and just the high level, you know, at one point in the season, he was averaging both a career high in minutes and a career high in usage. And that's just a lot to put on any player. And then you're also asking a certain amount from him defensively, just because of the style of defense the Lakers play, and teams will also try to target him and go at him. So I think it's more so that, but I don't know. I don't know what the alternative, like, you can't really sit him. I mean, obviously if he's really injured, you have to sit him, right? Like you got to put player health first and foremost, but it seems like something he's going to just have to play through and sort of get through. That does give me a little bit of concern though, just because guys can play through things and then just be hurt and not ever really get back to being at like their peak level, which I do think there's been a clear gap between like pre 1 week break for Luka and post 1 week break for Luka. But I don't, to me, it's not really a weight or conditioning thing, because I don't think conditioning, maybe if he was like really struggling in fourth quarters or second halves and struggling, then it's been a lot of like opening the game he is struggling. And you know, as Jason has mentioned, with the turnovers or some of the shot selection or whatever. So I don't think it's really a conditioning thing. I think he's just looked not quite himself physically. And I attribute that more honestly to probably some sort of injury than anything.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ovan. I think it's worth mentioning that, like, I think he's still generally just a little bit doughy, and there's probably another level he can get to in terms of his personal conditioning, but he seems more or less in the same territory he was in to start the season. And I agree with Jovan. He just looks a little banged up. And I think that really, like, if you want to get really nitpicky with Luka, it's like, will he be less banged up if he reaches another level in terms of his conditioning? Possibly, you know, I think that Luka took a big step forward from last year in terms of taking care of his body, but I do think that there's still another level he can get to.
I think the wear and tear is certainly a factor at this point in the season. The Lakers have not had the games like, say, the Thunder have, where their guys are sitting the entire fourth quarter. When they've won, it's been very close games. If they have had times for guys to sit the fourth quarter, it's because they're getting blown out in losses. Fortunately, they've won more than they've lost. So I think there have been a lot of minutes on Luka. There have been a lot of minutes on the key guys, and perhaps that's rearing its ugly head right now. The NBA season, though, we've already seen probably the biggest non-All-Star break rest period for the Lakers around the NBA Cup tournament schedule. So it's not like there's a rest period coming up necessarily for Luka, especially when he's certainly going to be involved in All-Star weekend based on the voting results here, which isn't a surprise. Keeping Rui with LeBron, Luka in a starting group, is JJ still considered a coach with a young, flexible, creative brain, which I thought he was? We kind of already addressed this one, so I don't think we need to dive back into that. But we do appreciate the super chat. But I'm glad we just had that JJ conversation just a few moments ago. Let's go here. Cameron said, we bring in Wiggins, second round pick for Rui, Gabe, and a protected first. So you're giving up a protected first and you're getting a second rounder for Wiggins. Josh Green, a second round pick for Kleba. So you're taking and connect. I'm not sure if you get that. We'll see. Good deadline, and shout out to the big three of Lakers media. Well, thank you, first of all, for being here, and appreciate the shout out.
Thank you.
Let's start with that first trade. I think bringing back a second is interesting. If you got back a second in the deal, would you be willing to give a protected first to effectively turn Rui and an expiring contract in Gabe into Andrew Wiggins?
I don't hate either of those trades. Go ahead.
I'm a little bit more skeptical on the second one being realistic. I don't know that Charlotte would give up a second round pick, and they're giving up the best player in the deal and a second round pick.
I thought the Lakers were sending that pick out. Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah. So I think that it would probably have to be the Lakers actually attaching another asset here, or at least like taking that asset out. That would be my only thing here, because I know Charlotte liked Dalton. I mean, there's the whole situation with LA and Charlotte that was pretty contentious, and yeah. LA did a cardinal sin of rescinding a trade that, you know, clearly Charlotte took shots at them publicly, and that was not a pretty situation. But I would be shocked if Charlotte views Dalton Connect in anywhere close to the same light that they viewed him in February. So that's where I'm a little skeptical of the second one. I like the second one. I would do it from the Lakers perspective, and I would do the first one too. But I just wanted to say that on adding in the second from the Charlotte side.
If you could turn Dalton right now, because I'm curious to do a value check here. If you could turn Dalton right now into a second round pick that does not project to be in the top 38, let's say. So it's not 31 through 38. It would be sometime after 38. It would project to be somewhere in that range. Would you do that?
That's a good question. Probably. So it's probably right about what his value is right now.
So we're saying like a top 38 protected second round pick.
Yeah, like a second round pick that would be like you would project would land at, I don't know, 42, something like that.
I still might take the Dalton side just to hope that he can figure things out. I will note, like, first round picks tend to hold, or former first round picks tend to hold a certain level of value. Of how many times have we seen, thinking through the years, like Wesley Johnson actually ended up being like a decent rotation player, but in the beginning of his career was rough, and he was bouncing around a little bit and getting second and third chances in part because he was the number four pick, right? And now there's a bit of a difference between a top five pick versus Dalton at 17, but I still think like a lot of top 20 picks will get a second or maybe even third chance just because of the theoretical upside. So I would maybe hold on to Dalton in that case and hope that some team will talk themselves into him. But he's about to be 25. Like he's going to turn 25 in a few months here. He's getting pretty close to, like, he kind of is who he is. And I think that's probably a borderline rotation guy on a good team. And that might be optimistic.
Yeah. It's what's crazy is he's almost a year older than Jake LaRavia.
That is crazy.
He's 2 years older than Max Christie. That was the thing with the whole Luka trade. I would have much rather given up Dalton than Max.
Yeah.
I thought Dalton would be better than that.
Would have been brilliant.
I thought he'd at least be a knockdown 3-point shooter, and he just hasn't been.
Man. All right, we'll go here. A couple of Rui comments to close things out. Starting Rui maximizes his trade value. And then this one, starting to feel like Rui is to JJ what Torian Prince is to Darvin Ham.
Well, don't forget Gabe Vincent, because JJ might have two Torian Princes.
Oh, two princes.
I get that to a degree. I think I got a similar comment last night on my show, and the one thing I noted was that I think there is a bit of a difference between how the fan base or most of the fan base and outside observers, like not even necessarily ourselves, but also like, you know, the broader NBA media or like ecosystem view Rui, and how the Lakers internally view Rui. I do think they are much higher on Rui as a starting level piece, as a potential guy that they would extend. Doesn't mean he's not tradable, but I'm not like actively seeking out a Rui trade, right? Like I think Gabe and Matt, like Gabe, Maxi, Dalton, okay, I think those three guys are on the block and would be moved in the right deal. Rui is a guy that I think the Lakers would actually have to be, it would have to be a, like such an upgrade of like a, you know, a Herb Jones type or someone like that. Maybe Wiggins, you know, maybe Wiggins and Brooks. I think but we don't even know if those guys are available right now. But I've seen some Rui trades where it's almost like a like for like. and it's not necessarily a clear upgrade. And I don't think the Lakers would do that type of trade unless they were getting an additional asset back, you know, compared to that player. So like I think DeAndre Hunter is an interesting example of, I don't think the Lakers would do just like a straight up Rui for DeAndre Hunter swap, even though I think a lot of fans would want that. And even outside people would probably say DeAndre Hunter is better than Rui. I don't think the Lakers would consider that or view it that way. So I think there is, I agree in general or in theory that there is like preserving his value as like a starter can help his trade value. I also think there's just an element of internally and politically, they really like Rui and that, you know, he's viewed in a certain light that I think it might just, you know, be that as well, where they just don't want to bench him or they think despite the lineup data that he is like that much better than Vando or Jake or whoever else.
I think that there's, when we look at that Rui trades, I do agree. I think the Lakers like Rui Hachimura. I can tell you one thing for sure that they should not do, unless they're getting some kind of crazy bargain. He is extension eligible right now. You are not extending Rui until after the trade deadline. The trade deadline needs to pass before you do anything like that. Unless it's Rui gives you some kind of crazy bargain. He says, hey, I'll do 4 years, 40, something like that. Okay, right. Then we're talking about it's such a crazy bargain. You just do it. But otherwise, if he's wanting any kind of an increase or anything like that, you do not want to do a contract extension with him right now. Keep him as an expiring. And if you're going to move him, if you are going to consider moving him in trades, you let the new team getting him decide what they want that next contract to look like. He is extension eligible all the way up until June 30th. So it's possible we could hear right on the eve of free agency, the Lakers come to a new deal with Rui. And it wouldn't shock me. They do like Rui. It wouldn't shock me at all if he winds up sticking long-term with the team. He's already been with the team for a fairly decent amount of time. I can just say you don't want to do that strategically right now. Even if they like Rui, you want to wait till after the trade deadline before you make any kind of a decision like that. If Rui is still a Laker past February 5th, then you can start talking extensions and keeping him around long term. All right, let's go. Last one here. Pistons are going to either be a close win or a huge loss. That's what history tells us.
That's the only way we know how to play, guys.
That's it.
That's Lakers basketball.
Oh, man. All right, everybody. Thank you guys for joining the show. We appreciate all of you. You guys are fantastic. Please make sure you do subscribe to the channel. Follow us over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts as well. And once again, thank you to SeatGeek for sponsoring this show. Guys, as always, this was a blast and it had a great time talking Lakers with you.
It's good to see you, dudes. You want to go Wednesday? Should we go right after the Pistons game? Lakers don't play on Thursday or Friday or Wednesday or Thursday. So if you guys are down, I'm down to go Wednesday.
Let's do Wednesday.
Sure.
Hell yeah.
Sounds good to me. We're
making moves.
Talk about after that one. All right, everybody. We'll see you on Wednesday. Till then, see you and stay safe.